we go with the jobs, really. I mean, if there's a potential for a great piece of architecture, we're interested.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture.
You know, when it came to sort of year three and, you know, who to work for, you know, one wrote to Foster's, one wrote to Rogers, he wrote to Hopkins, I think I wrote to Michael Manser, Cedric Price, and a few others, and, you know, you got answers back. It all seemed much easier in those days.
When you work for someone else, that you become a chameleon, so you can fit in. But then when you start on your own, you have to decide which way you want to go.
On the programme this week, we speak to Chris Wilkinson and Jim Eyre, directors of Wilkinson Eyre Architects.
I'm Jim Eyre, director of Wilkinson Eyre.
I'm Chris Wilkinson, founding director of Wilkinson Eyre.
And I'm Owen Wainhouse. Chris founded Chris Wilkinson Architects in 1983, with Jim joining the practice, now Wilkinson Eyre Architects, in 1987. The practice now employs more than 200 people in London, Hong Kong and Sydney. Chris originally studied architecture at the Regent Street Polytechnic, now part of the University of Westminster, before going on to work for Dennis Lasden, Norman Foster, Michael Hopkins and Richard Rogers. Jim studied at Liverpool University and at the Architectural Association in London, before working for Hopkins Architects, where the two met. The practice has won numerous awards, including the RABA Stirling Prize, 2 years running, in 2001 for the Magna Centre in Rotherham, and in 2002 for the Gateshead Millennium Bridge. They won the RABA's International Lubetkin Award for the Guangzhou International Finance Centre in China, and continue to gain a significant amount of work from overseas. The practice is currently on site, overseeing the plans for the renovation of Sir Giles Gilbert Scott's iconic Battersea Power Station in London. I joined Jim and Chris in their studio in Clerkenwell, just over the road from where the practice started some three decades ago.
We came to Clerkenwell in the 90s, towards the end of the 90s. We shared the space with Zaha. In the school.
They're still there, are they? Over the...
Yeah, they've taken over the whole of the school.
Right.
But in those days, we started with one room, and Zaha had one room on the top. Then we grew a bit, and she was starting to grow, and we were looking for a bigger space. And we moved to, onto the roundabout, Old Street roundabout.
I think when we moved in, we were around about 10 or 11 people at the beginning of the time in Clerkenwell.
And even less, I think.
Might have been slightly less. We were squeezed into one room. We were fitting out the other room and expanded into that. And I think when we left Clerkenwell, that particular building, we must have been around about 30-odd people, something like that, because we took the room next door.
And the floor above, some of the floor above as well.
Is it strange then, kind of sharing with another practice?
Well, we weren't sharing directly. We weren't sharing actual space. They just happened to be on the floor above.
Okay.
And then they gradually expanded.
We didn't see an awful lot of Zaha. But, okay. I mean, we borrowed... they used to borrow things from us.
Is that borrow? What's the...
Projectors and things. Okay. And we knew some of the people as well.
Yeah, and they would ask questions now and again about various things.
Right. But the practice then was founded 83 originally as Chris Wilkinson Architects.
Yes, I set up the practice after leaving Richard Rogers' office.
Okay. And you'd worked for a number. You'd worked for Norman for a while, for Richard Rogers.
Michael Hopkins.
And Hopkins, okay. We interviewed Patty. Couple of months ago now as well. And just be interested then to kind of your
well,
where did you study? Where was your architecture?
Regent Street Polytechnic. And I worked for Dennis Lasden to start with, and then for my tutor for a while. And then I took a sabbatical, about 4 months in Italy, France and Greece. and I sort of could see the future. At a moment in time, I saw the future as being a future of modernism was going to be with Foster and Rogers, and I headed back to London, applied to both of them, and got a job at Foster's.
Right. So how long with Norman? How long at Foster's?
I was only there but 2.5, just under 3 years, yes. Okay. And then Michael Hopkins split off from Norman, yeah, offered me a job, and that was the beginning of Michael Hopkins Architects. And then later, when I set up on my own, Michael asked me to come back and to help out on a project, and that's where I met Jim.
Right, working at Hopkins then, you're...
Yes, yeah. Yes. I studied architecture initially at Liverpool University, right, 3 years there. And at the end of those 3 years, I wrote to all the architects that I liked. Yeah. And in those days, you used to get letters back from the, yeah, principals, which was always quite nice. So. And I was offered a year-out job with Michael Hopkins, which I took very happily because I was a great admirer of his house in, yeah, Hampstead. Yeah. And I likewise was very much, you know, very interested in the architecture of the Fosters, Rogers, Hopkins, that kind of high-tech or so-called high-tech architecture was, you know, what I was into at university. So I worked there, and then I worked quite a lot after my year out, while I was at the AA for 2 years, doing AA diploma, I continued to work part-time at Hopkins and just carried on, I think, for a total of, it would have been 5 years all up. And we were working together probably for two of those years. A
couple of years, yes.
And then Chris suggested that maybe I'd like to join. I was sort of thinking of leaving Hopkins anyway, and so I joined with Chris, and then we formed a partnership.
We were starting to get some work.
Partnership in, when was it, 87?
Yes,
yeah, so. 1987.
Well, kind of, I mean, it's interesting, we're talking to Patty about the kind of nature of partnerships, and her obviously with Michael and the two of them kind of forming a practice. What is it between two individuals that you just, you know, is it something that you share a kind of a vision, or you share a kind of sensibility for architecture? What do you think kind of draws people together to form a practice in terms of...
I think shared values sounds good. shared ideas of... I mean, it would be difficult if you had opposing ideas about architecture, yeah, wouldn't it?
But sometimes people, you know, some of the people we speak to talk about having different people in the practice or different partners are better at some things than others. You get people maybe who enjoy the kind of client liaison more or enjoy the kind of...
I think that goes with the territory, actually. You know, I mean, if you're talking about when we started together, then it was, you know, we were a very small office at the time. So, you know, on one level, you can sort of cover for each other. The shared values, as Chris says, are important. Same sort of interests and excitement about architecture. So creatively, you know, pulling in the same direction.
Okay.
But I think as a practice grows and you bring in more people, actually, it's you know, you have that opportunity to have lots of different people with slightly different attributes and interests.
That's a kind of creative tension then, is that?
Well,
is
when
that
we started, we did employ people from different backgrounds. And I found that very interesting because, you know, I'd had rather a sort of distinct sort of line of work.
Yeah.
In a, so, as you say, the sort of high-tech architecture. And we employed some people from completely different backgrounds, and it was very interesting.
You weren't having arguments about Georgian facades or something then coming into your...
No, it was more sort of arty people.
Right, okay. But you're, I was going to say notoriously, but that's the wrong word, but you're known for your kind of artistic background and your, certainly some of the watercolours and the kind of painting.
Well, from my point of view, it's a very important part of my life, and my approach to architecture, really, although I started on the sort of technical side, moved in a different direction slightly. When you work for someone else, I was saying this just this last week to someone in Venice, that that you become a chameleon, so you can work with lots of people. You can fit in. But then when you start on your own, you have to decide which way you want to go. And actually, Jim and I had probably started with some of the same experience, and we tried all sorts of different things.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think at the time, I think we still are very interested in how things go together, you know, so actually making things, how things are made. You know, I think that high-tech thing is all about, you know, how you join materials up and what things are made of, how they're expressed, how you express structure, etc. I think over the years, one's attitude to that broadens, rather, you know, and you start to think more about other aspects of architecture. And I think, I mean, for me, you know, I did scribble and draw and so on, but I don't do so much recreational drawing. In any sense, but the nature of how one works in a modern architecture office is so different from the way it was, you know, when actually it was all on a drawing board and the very act of drawing was part of the creative process. Now you're sitting over people or you're sitting in meetings and you can do a lot of the creative work by just instructing somebody.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, it's a two-way thing.
It's a different kind of form of language, maybe,
of trying things and making things on screen and in the model shop, et cetera, et cetera.
So interesting, we started talking a little bit about the kind of artistic sensibility and the kind of root in there. What, interested in jumping right back, really, in terms of motivations for becoming architects. When did you realise you wanted to be an architect? I mean, when was the... Often it runs in a family.
Run in the family, but I decided quite early on, at about 14, I think, school. And it was simply that, actually, with my father in the holidays, I met some architects. He's a surveyor. And I found them to be interesting people.
Your father was a surveyor, right? So there's kind of an interest in property there, I suppose.
And it was not knowing much about the subject, but meeting some people that I thought were kind of a bit different. And that's what attracted me.
Well, interestingly, I think it was a similar age, probably 14 or 15, that kind of age, that... I was always quite good at art at school, you know. I mean, I was, you know, spent a lot of time in the art studio, painting and drawing and so on. But I was also reasonably good at sciences and maths, not genius level by any means, but, you know, that combination. I kind of knew I wanted to do something that had an artistic side to it. Otherwise, I would, you know, I'd get bored. It wouldn't work really, and. I don't know. I didn't know anyone who was an architect, and I don't think anyone at school really had gone into architecture that I knew particularly. But it did seem to be a logical career choice and quite interesting. And I started taking... In fact, my mother started booked me in to get subscriptions to Architectural Review from about... I think the earliest ones I had were about 1976. And I remember being incredibly excited by, it would have been around about 76, the Pompidou Centre, thinking, you know, this is extraordinary where architecture's going. You know, and you could see the opportunities.
But no real kind of what you might call role models then, you know, to kind of people you were seeing.
No, not at all.
And so you straight into Hopkins, to work for Hopkins then, was that your previous...
Well, I think I had a holiday job... I had some work experience with a firm called GMW,
okay.
A week or so, you know, trying to, probably messing up their tracing drawings and spilling black ink on things.
Yeah.
And then I did some holiday work at Holford Associates,
all right.
Which it didn't inspire me at all, actually. And it was only from looking at AR that one could see there was rather more to architecture than
what you were doing.
Than what they were doing, you know, what I had seen in practice. But I think, you know, when it came to sort of year three and, you know, who to work for, you know, one wrote to Fosters, one wrote to Rogers, he wrote to Hopkins, I think I wrote to Michael Mansa, Cedric Price, and a few others. And, you know, you got answers back. And it all seemed much easier in those days.
I got offered a job on my diploma show by Dennis Lasden.
On the back of the diploma show?
Yes. It wasn't. He was one of his partners that was my external examiner and said, you should come for an interview. I went to see Dennis and he gave me a job. So I didn't know a lot about the practice at the time, but I was there for a couple of years and it was very interesting. I was a very different background. They're very good architects, really good quality architecture. But I felt somehow that I wanted to do something different after a while, so that's why I left.
And I'm kind of interested, actually, in a lot of practices about what... I mean, you've got, 180 staff here now?
Over 200.
Okay, out of date with my notes, but so 200 odd.
Over 200, yeah.
And a lot of people, you've got partners here, people who are very happy working for a big firm, but clearly other people, the two of you, I guess, are examples of that, wanting to set up something for yourself. What's the kind of drive for someone to set up their own firm rather than, do you think, to be a partner and, you know, to in someone else's firm? Is there a...
Well, it must be because you feel you've got something new to say.
Right.
And in my case, I worked in all the different practices and a lot of different practices, and I could have gone on like that, but I decided I wanted to do my own thing.
Right.
And it was a struggle, you know, because I had a big mortgage and two kids at expensive schools and no income, suddenly starting with no income.
Yeah. So it's a brave and bold thing to do in that.
Yes, but you have to take these decisions in life, don't you?
Yeah.
And
when you say you kind of want to, you kind of something else to say, is it to do with the style of architecture? Is it, do you think, to do with the kind of the type of clients you want to work with? What's the kind of, what is it that you're not able to?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't for money. Put it that way. No, it was. When you're working for other people, you slip into the mold. You do what you're expected to do.
Yeah.
When you set up on your own, you decide what you're going to do. And then it's a matter of trying to get the work, you know, that was the problem.
Right. And do you remember some of the kind of early, when you set up then, early clients that...
Yes.
Did they come across with you for moving, or were they just kind of bringing...
First clients was passed on by Richard Rogers. Which was the body conditioning studio, one of the first Pilates studios in the country. And then I did a job for Renzo Piano, the IBM Travelling Technology exhibit. And it was that sort of thing. People who knew... Peter Rice sent quite a few jobs in our direction because I'd worked with him closely.
So you kept a good, despite leaving some firms, you kept good relationships clearly with the people you had.
It's very important. It's a very small world.
But there were, I mean, at the time, there were quite a lot of, you know, the sort of conversion, residential conversion type projects in the office. But there was always at least one more interesting project going on, you know, something quite special. Anyway, I think I mean, at the time, if I'd stayed at Hopkins, I could have seen a path through it, but it, you know, you were always doing what somebody else wanted you to do, in a way, but you're learning a lot at the same time. And I think, you know, starting in a smaller practice, you know, the opportunity to influence things is much greater.
You talked about kind of having to be accommodating in a sense when you're working for someone else. Is there a change then to suddenly having to make decisions yourself? I mean, is that a kind of a learning curve that you're not, in a sense, if you've been used to kind of being accommodating and going with someone else's wishes, maybe?
Well, you're leading, aren't you? So it's, and it can be stressful, but it's also exciting, and it's kind of, yes, it's exciting.
It's also where the buck stops, isn't it, which is the big difference, I think.
But every time you have a new project, it's the same. You have to come up with the ideas, you have to get, it's very competitive. Yeah. Most of our work comes in competitions. So we have to win our share.
I mean, that maybe kind of coming on slightly to competitions then is an interesting. I hear all the people we speak to are kind of real divergence maybe in opinions in terms of some people who talk about, you know, the engagement of a client who's, you know, through competition, and other people who just think the amount of, even now, a lot of your work comes through competitions.
Well, you still...
Yeah, there's a certain absence in the engagement with a client during the competitive process. Yeah. Though quite often, sometimes you do get really quite clear briefs. And part of it is trying to get into the client's mind anyway. Yeah. So that whatever you're proposing is, you know, you feel will be on message, and that is something they're going to be interested in. But I don't think that just because the project starts out in life as a competition, that actually there's somehow a lesser relationship with the client. And in many ways it's...
I'm thinking maybe actually more a kind of...
I quite like it, because then they know your starting position generally is that you've done something that they like.
Yeah. Yeah.
You started with the position of strength,
exactly.
Actually.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're commissioned, you've got this sort of learning period. And you might get forced down a road you're not interested in. Not saying you do, but, you know, there's
that risk.
Possibility.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
a competition, you've got, they've selected you because they like the work you've done and the ideas you've come up with.
Okay. And so that's still a positive decision to pursue competitions now?
Well, I think almost all our work, in one way or another, comes from some sort of competitive process. With the amount of design that you do speculatively or relatively lowly remunerated, it varies. It does vary from being a huge amount of work to being sort of relatively quick. But it's enough. I can see from the client's point of view, it's fantastic. I mean, there are, you know, I think there are questions about the use of resources.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When you get lots of architects spending huge amounts of time on the same thing, effectively, it's not necessarily the most economically effective thing to do.
The other problem with commissions is if you're known for doing residential projects, you'll only be approached for residential projects, and if you want to change, if you want to get into some other field, the best way is through competitions.
And I suppose that's one of the notable things about your work is a big mix of tenures and types.
It's always been very deliberate, that I'd say planned or when it's unplanned, it still has the intention, you know, of actually trying to reach out and do different things. Wherever we think there's an opportunity, you know, for a new type or new type of project, we're always interested.
But not at, so I guess there's different types of buildings, but also different styles. And maybe you've avoided being, certainly talking about the practice opposite, you know, in terms of a style, and you know, Zaha's work kind of very much of a style. You've not been pigeonholed that way in terms of a...
No, it's because we don't talk about style.
No, I think we've managed to avoid that, and I think it's because every time we look at a project, we're trying to do something new. There's a kind of new way of thinking about it, in a sense, with all the kind of skills and everything you've learned, rather than... I don't know, it's sort of almost anathema to us to sort of look at a project and say, well, this is brand Wilkinson Air, therefore they'll be expecting such and such a thing, shape, whatever, or look. Where we like to start, in a way, from first principles, from a diagram, actually, of how something might work. So,
I mean, the kind of brand Wilkinson Air is an interesting, or kind of a lack of a kind of a brand style, maybe. That a number of your projects, you know, there's the Dyson headquarters, IKEA Museum, Carlsberg Brewery, they're kind of themselves very strong.
Yes, we work for strong brands, that's true, certainly true, yeah.
And do you think the two go hand in hand, in a sense, that your people are coming to you without, because they don't see a...
Well, I think those people are all interested in design, and so they would come to us as designers. So we have a long-standing relationship with Dyson. So we did the first building 20 years ago, and we've got 6 projects on the go at the moment for Dyson. We've grown up together, and we have a sort of sympathy in design terms, a relationship.
And I guess that's the other side of the competition then, that once you found a, you know, client, that, you know, the relationship works well.
But also, there are things that make sense. For instance, when we decided to go to get some projects abroad, we were concerned that all our eggs in one basket. In the UK, you get upturns and downturns. Obviously, you can spread it, it's going to help. And the first major project we got really was in China, because we had a couple of Chinese architects working for us, and they said we should go into China. This is before 2000 originally.
So quite kind of early on in that, yeah, a lot of British architects now working in China, quite an early...
It's a bit late now, actually, because they don't need us anymore. But and we won a major project in 2005 for one of the tallest buildings in the world, and we hadn't designed a tall building at that stage. Well, that wouldn't happen in many places.
No. So that's the International Finance Centre.
Guangzhou International Finance Centre.
Pursuing towers? Had you been pursuing?
We were interested in working abroad, and we could see that China was going to had a huge potential. And the first project actually was in Beijing, which we won the competition, but we didn't get to build it.
But I think we had some unbuilt tower projects before Guangzhou.
Yes.
Not in China, actually. There was one in London, and we had done other work. The Empress was preceded it too. So we'd done work on extending the Empress State Building down in Hammersmith. So we already had that interest. I think there was at the time, and I think there still is, that there was a sort of consistent interest in these sort of superstructures, in a sense, you know, like bridges and towers. I think, you know, have a certain amount in common, where the engineering is so fundamental within the design that, you know, you've got to try and get everything working together well. The structure, services, you know, planning, efficiency. There are lots of things that play well to, you know, that kind of ordered way of thinking and designing that we rather enjoy.
We didn't find it very difficult, actually.
No, but there's also, I think the towers, particularly Guangzhou at the time, I certainly felt, I know you felt the same, that there was something missing about the way that other people were doing towers.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's top, middle and bottom. You know, you had something slightly interesting on the bottom, a funny top, and then it's sort of straight up in between. And we just, I didn't feel anyone was really doing them as a pure sculptural form. We're really, really just concentrating on the whole form of the tower.
And those ideas.
Also the aerodynamics of a tower.
Yeah, there were lots of other
There were
reasons.
People designing very tall buildings with lots of bits sticking out. Well, that's crazy, because you've got to look after these things, and they cause turbulence and, you know, problems, really. So we tried to go for a sort of an aerodynamic form, which was quite smooth and related to the wind. There were very high wind forces there, as well as seismic problems. So there was a lot of good reason for having a fairly simple form.
Quite through a lot of projects then, a kind of respect for engineering and a real... You've received a few awards from the Royal Institution of Engineers, Royal...
The Royal Academy of Engineering.
Kind of in recognition, really, of that respect, do you think, for...
I think it was probably to do with Gateshead Millennium Bridge, which was, you know, it was very successful, made quite a big impression. But, you know, we're not engineers. We can't do the calculations.
Right.
I think we just have a sort of reasonable, intuitive understanding of structures. And, you know, not all of our projects by any means, in fact, most of them, don't necessarily show off the structure. They don't always have structure. Okay. But if you're going to have structure, we'd like to make it elegant.
Yeah. But I'm interested in that kind of relationship that architects have then with engineers. You know, sometimes one gets the impression that it's a difficult relationship for some practices, do you think? I mean, that's never been the case here.
I think one of the most important things, and certainly about the way one works now, is the collaborative nature of working. And so it's always better to work with engineers that have got a bit of an interest in architecture, you know, and kind of understand what you're trying to do. And likewise, for us to work with engineers where we have some understanding, interest and care about what they're doing. And it stimulates the discussion. So you tend to get, you know, you get more out of it in terms of the possibilities than you might do otherwise. So that for us, the days of doing the design and handing it over to engineer and asking him to just put the structure on, it's gone. I mean, that just isn't like that.
Right.
It's collaborative.
And we can tell when the engineering's going in the right direction. I think both of us feel the same. So, you know, I mean, there are good engineers and not so good engineers, but I think, you know, you can tell when it's moving in the right direction and encourage, you need to encourage it to work out as part of the architecture. The engineering becomes part of the architecture, really.
We might come on then to the Millennium Bridge in Gateshead. I mean, there's one... 2001, was that what it was?
Yeah, I think it was completed about 2001.
So kind of part, really, of what I call a kind of urban renaissance, maybe, in many kind of British cities, part of a kind of period of regeneration of city centres, maybe in the UK.
Yes, I think it was. And, I mean, it was a very particular circumstance there, you know, that they wanted a bridge. You know, one side of the river was kind of very established, the Newcastle side, really, and the Gateshead side, you know, with the kind of disappearance of shipbuilding and docks and so on that far up the river and the warehouses, etc. The Gateshead side had very little on it. You know, there was just a bit of a wasteland. You had to get further back to get into Gateshead, back from the river. So I think they saw the possibility that you could have essentially what will be a piece of public space linking up the two quays, which in that particular city are at a low level compared to the city centres on either side. There was only one other low level bridge, the Armstrong Bridge, the Swing Bridge, and that you put the two together and you start to create a route. And it was just, I mean, with those structures, with bridges, there's always something in the brief that kind of makes you think of an idea, or something that's missing in the brief that makes you think of an
idea.
Was
that a competition win?
It was then? A competition win, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And a real kind of, again, engineer. I guess a lot of people think about bridges and...
But it's by its nature, it's engineering, but I wouldn't say that the concept is engineering. Yeah. The concept is about a spatial experience and the way that the thing opens, that you could open something in a really unusual, unexpected way.
So that was the practice's first Stirling Prize.
Second.
Was the first.
Was before.
We were very lucky in that the Millennium Project started to come out at the time where we were starting to gain a sort of reputation, having done the Jubilee Line projects, two Jubilee Line projects. And then these Millennium Projects were all competitions. And we won quite a few. I mean, we got our share anyway. First one, I think, was in Bristol. And then the Magna one was a kind of slightly unusual one, in that it was a huge project with very little money and needed a bit of magic, really. And there was a very short program for the design part of it. We were very pleased to win it. And I remember thinking, going up to the building after we'd won and thinking, what have we done? You know, there were no drawings of it. It's a huge building. It's sort of half as big again as the Tate Modern, maybe twice as big. And no drawings, no information, no money.
Yeah.
And but we made it work.
But the money came, was it, through the kind of Millennium?
Yes.
There's a lot of... And actually, I mean, that's, yeah, there's a kind of...
But it was a tenth the amount of money that was spent on Tate Modern, for instance. I mean, it was a minuscule amount for the size of the project.
But that was partly the kind of recognition through Stirling, then, is the kind of abilities to do such amazing architecture with so little funding. I mean, that's a real skill.
That's nice to hear. But, I mean, actually, it was also about... the expectations and what was available. I mean, it was a very simple building and we had to bring it alive to make it into a destination.
Yeah. I'm kind of interested then, that Millennium period, now we kind of think about it, certainly the Jubilee Line extension in London in terms of kind of being fundamental to certainly kind of connectivity in East London. The next kind of big bit, certainly in London, of regeneration was kind of connected to the Olympics, where you had another temporary building for the Olympics.
Yes, the basketball arena. Yeah.
Competition win.
It was a competition. Well, it was a competition, but it wasn't specifically a competition for a design for a building. It was much more about an approach. So we actually showed a whole range of different systems, you know, that one might put together, you know, ways of putting together a temporary building, but also for potential reuse of the structure. And at the beginning, they were very, very interested in how the building could be reassembled to become something else. But I think with the budgetary pressures, it became slightly less focused on that, but used, you know, the way that the building was procured kind of evolved, so there were only some parts that could be reused, some parts were hired in, etc. So it was a really interesting process, actually, as a way of designing a building, with quite a long lead-in for us, actually, from the competition to completion. There was quite a long, quite a lot of time spent on it.
Okay. I've spoken to other...
We also did the crystal.
That's the Siemens crystal. In
Yes, but that was an accompanying Olympic project. It wasn't actually part of the Olympics, but it was one of those projects, I suppose, that Boris Johnson was sort of encouraging people to do at the time when he was mayor of London.
Yeah. And the other, I mean, moving on then to the airline,
The cable car as well. Those two they came together almost. I mean, they're very, very close together. Yeah.
Transport then seems to
our first major buildings were transport, you know, Stratford Market Depot, and which I think was on a shortlist for the Stirling, wasn't it? It was on the
Stratford Station
and the station,
so also shortlisted.
I mean, there was a time where we might have got, you know, might have only been doing transport buildings for the rest of our lives if we hadn't branched out.
Deliberately branched out. Mm. Yeah.
And we are still doing transport buildings.
Yeah. And actually, it was those that led to the bridges, really, wasn't it?
Yes, it was directly, actually. The Stratford station, I think, really, that we were working on at the time. There was somebody at Newham who was asked us to, would we be in, like to be part of a bridge competition in South Keys, just south of Canary Wharf. And I think they had identified 9 other architects and 10 engineers. And there was a sort of, well, they gave us the name of the 10 engineers and said, go and pick one. You know, and I think we were last to be picked. I think it was the other way around.
We were definitely the last.
We were definitely the last to be picked, but we won the competition, and then we won the next four. I think the next 4 bridge competitions that we entered. So people think that's what we do.
Yeah.
Bridges and railway buildings.
But kind of interesting again. Then in terms of, I'm kind of always interested in how, I guess for us as a festival, encouraging people to think about the architecture of the routes that they take through tube stations and the routes that they kind of, the kind of flow of people, and seeing that very much as architecture and architectural decision making, but quite hard to explain that, I guess, to a
kind of white... It's hard to explain, but I think when we were designing bridges, and we still are, those are the things we're thinking about. You know, it's not just how to get from one side to the other, it's how it relates to what's happening on either side. And, you know, thinking of them as a piece of public space. So you are thinking about that kind of level of urban design.
That's where it started, really, when the architects started to get involved, because there was a concern. The Royal Fine Arts Commission, I think, wrote a paper on it, that bridges were such an important part of the urban realm and the rural realm, for that matter, that they needed to be considered as part of the space and not just as a piece of engineering.
Yeah. Some of the, I guess, as a firm, architecture firm develops in size and you bring on other directors to help support the work that you're doing, guess there comes a time when you start getting a little bit more headspace to bring in other interests. So whether that's lecturing again or some of your work with the Royal Academy, just kind of interested in those other interests that as architects start to...
Well, on your first point, I mean, other directors, quite a lot of the directors, in fact, the core of directors here, people that have been here an awfully long time, when we were a small office doing those first railway projects, and kind of grew with us, and have pretty much mostly, I think only one has left, so they've stayed. So the 8 directors at present, I think only 2 of them really come from later than that period. So they all work, the other 4 worked on the Stratford Market Depot in the early days.
So there's a real continuity there in the practice and knowing.
A sort of way of doing things.
And we've grown up together, really.
Yeah.
Right.
And then other interests, and I mean, I'll talk about mine a little bit. I've been involved with Design Council for quite a long time, though I'm no longer a trustee there. I finished back in December, but for several years.
Kind of design review.
So started off by doing design review at CABE for a number of years, chairing design reviews. It was something that I found really interesting and kind of rewarding. And, you know, you do it because you feel you can help improve schemes a bit by that contribution. I also have been involved quite a lot at the Architectural Association, initially on council. I was president I did my bit at president. I'm still on the AA Foundation. More recently, over the last 2 or 3 years, I've been involved with the Royal Commission for the Exhibition of 1851, which is really, as a commissioner, which is really more, and I was before that, on the built environment fellowship selection panel. So really, that I mean, the core interest on that actually is relating to handing out or interviewing, researching for fellowships for research projects. So it's kind of putting something back, I guess, is part of it.
I was a commissioner for English Heritage for 4 years or 4 or 5 years. Then I was elected to the Royal Academy, and I really enjoyed that. I've been involved in, the architects get involved in doing quite a lot of the work. So I was involved in, right from the beginning, of 6 Burlington Gardens, appointing the architect.
That must be interesting as a kind of client, slightly more client side.
And I was chair of the committee that looked after it.
Yeah.
Through the process with David Chipperfield. And that process took nearly 10 years. But I've enjoyed that, you know, and done a bit of teaching. We both shared teaching role at IIT and Harvard.
Right.
We haven't really had many opportunities in the UK. External examining on 3 or 4 universities, that sort of thing. So we do, I think these things happen and one takes them on and enjoys the process, really.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of lectures, quite a lot of lectures.
What you might kind of call I guess the pressures of starting and growing a business then, what you might kind of call extracurricular things outside, of which your early work in the festival was one, the Clerkenwell, when was that, 2004, Clerkenwell Architecture Biennale?
I'm not sure. I got involved very early on, and I thought that it was a good idea to, because there are a lot of architects working in the area, and that we could all get together and do something. Peter Murray, I think, he really started it and got us involved, and it's grown a lot since. And I think it is a worthwhile thing to do, to get the architects in conversation and following through ideas together.
I'm just fascinated though, really, about, I guess, kind of architecture practices generally, but the ability when you talked about some of the stress and things of setting up a practice and the buck stopping with you and it being a sizable business and having to bring a steady stream of clients and competition wins through, that people, architects, find the time to do other things, really, and kind of other slightly more vocational things, for kind of societal good. What do you think, kind of, I mean, I can't really, think about other professions, do lawyers a disservice, but I don't know whether lawyers or,
I think people do. I think people do things. I mean, lawyers might appear on those charity trustees and things, on various things. So I think they do. But I also think that, as the practice grows and has got bigger, there's enough management, in a sense, within the office, within the practice, to actually allow a certain amount of time for people to do extracurricular things. And it's not all down to one person. No. It can be spread.
And is that, I guess, because it's a creative discipline in that sense, the kind of creativity that, or the kind of headspace to think, I guess?
I think the other thing, I mean, lectures, teaching, etc., just reviewing or external examining as well, looking at other students' work, actually makes you think about your own work.
Yeah.
So otherwise you're just too closed up if you don't do those things. You've got to expose yourself. Just as you've got to go and look at buildings.
Yeah.
Other people's buildings, old buildings, etc.
I like giving lectures. I think you learn, it makes you think about what you're doing because you're presenting your work and your ideas. And we've published quite a lot of books as well, which I think that's another way of re-examining what you're up to, really. And I think, you know, writing, one of the first books we did, Jim and I wrote 4 essays each. And I think some of the architectural critics were rather critical about the fact that architects were writing their own texts.
We didn't employ somebody to write it for us.
Putting them out of a job, yeah.
But I think, I don't know, but I think it was a terrific thing to do. It was a struggle, you know, because we set ourselves, we gave ourselves a title for each essay. And it's really still fundamentally the principles of practice, really, the design as principles of our practice are in those essays.
We've also made exhibitions. You know, we had one at the Science Museum, and that was another opportunity to sort of look at the work in a slightly different way and present it.
And the Biennale.
And the Biennale. And we've just, in fact, an exhibition has just finished in Hong Kong, the Fringe in Hong Kong, where we've exhibited our work for 2 weeks. A number of us were over there. You know, finding new ways of showing your work, and looking at it in a different light.
In a kind of slightly self-critical way.
Yeah,
of thinking
it's very about stimulating.
It. That's interesting to talk about Hong Kong and, I guess, the Far East and increasingly Australia have been, you might call, kind of focus areas for you as a practice. Again, is that...
Well, the Australian... We go with the jobs, really. I mean, if it's a great piece of, there's a potential for a great piece of architecture, we're interested.
Right, wherever it is.
And the Sydney project was an international competition which we had a chance for, and we went for it. But that came out of other competitions such as Gardens by the Bay, which
Singapore,
had been successful in Singapore. And also work at Kew Gardens. And
a lot of work at Kew's.
And actually the also the Guangzhou project, because that was a tall building. So, you know, you take your opportunities when they come up.
And what's the kind of mix now, do you think, between work in the UK and work overseas for the practice? What's the
I think it's more than a third, probably, overseas. Slightly more than a third. It got up to about 40%. But I think when you look at our... You know, you look at our projects, most, you know, they're not easy projects. They're quite special. Yeah. They're not the sort of, here's a simple building in Hong Kong or whatever. There's always something kind of quite tricky about them, actually, about the brief and the context. I mean, Battersea, for instance, Battersea Power Station, is an immensely complicated project.
Yeah. Gas holders.
Gas holders. The Singapore we mentioned. You know, it's
Toronto.
Highly unusual.
The Toronto project, which is on site at the moment, that's two towers, but with a park spanning over the railway, right next to the central station. So, very complicated project.
Is that the first kind of foray into North America?
First. Right. It is being built, will be built, foray into North America. There's other things. We've looked at all sorts of things in the States. We've entered a lot of competitions. Yeah. Generally, in the USA, it's quite difficult to win.
By competition.
Because quite often they have international competitions and then the American wins.
Completely by accident. Yeah. Right.
We've had a few examples of that.
Right.
So it's quite hard. It's quite hard, I think, in the USA.
And maybe it kind of puts you off then entering more, maybe.
We're always very optimistic and enthusiastic.
That maybe just brings us to start to kind of to round up, brings us back to London, and somebody talked about Battersea. It's a kind of huge project for London. Just interested to hear a bit about, was that a competition win? How did you...
It was a fairly short competition, actually, with and a very prescriptive as to what they wanted. I think it was something like 6 boards, and there was a series of themes they wanted us to look at on each board. So it wasn't really a requirement to do a design as such.
Okay. But this, I mean, I guess for people listening, this is... There's a lot going on in Battersea. This is the actual power station structure itself.
It is the power station itself, not the buildings around it.
Left dormant for, 30 years? I mean, a big...
Since the mid-1980s, it stopped.
I think initially they well, it was a telephone call. I think they telephoned 10 architects.
Right.
Not all to do the same job, but to meet and discuss the possibilities. And then we got shortlisted. Actually, for the main building, as it happened.
But I think, you know, we needed to demonstrate that we could work with listed buildings, which we have done quite a lot. And also, I happened to be still working on the New Bodleian Library, now the Western Library, which is a Giles Gilbert Scott building.
Oxford.
So we sort of quite got into understanding Giles Gilbert Scott, who's a sort of slightly unusual architect. An approach that was sort of almost modernism, but not quite.
Right, like a crossover.
And we've done some retail and residential and office. Right. These are the main sort of elements.
You know, we've demonstrated an ability to work on very large projects, which not every office can do.
And then I guess just kind of interested, are you both from London originally?
Home counties, yes, right, Surrey, Surrey initially, and then Hertfordshire. Right.
Yes, I'm Hertfordshire.
Right. But being in London then for all your careers, really?
Since I was 18, I lived in London.
Kind of grown up with the city then.
Yeah.
I was kind of interested in thoughts on being changed to London in those period at which you've been building London or shaping London.
When I first came to London, it was in the 60s. And London was the centre of the world, really. I mean, it was quite unbelievable. And the world was changing very fast.
Yeah.
And actually, London really led the sort of fashion, design, music. Mm. All these things were happening in London and then spinning off around the world.
Yeah.
So it was a very exciting place. Still is.
Yeah.
It looked very different then. And I think the other thing about it, I mean, it's changed, particularly around here in Clerkenwell, there's an enormous change. You know, when we first moved here, we were effectively displaced from the West End. You know, we were surrounded by people who were sort of metal bashers, clockmakers, etc., and small workshops. And those people eventually moved out. But I remember, you know, many years ago, if you'd come to Farringdon Station in the evening, it would be deserted.
Yeah.
And now it's just absolutely teeming with people.
Yeah.
It's changed drastically, actually.
And that, so you're thinking about kind of transport, which the Crossrail stations you're working on?
Yeah,
now,
they're being built.
Which stations are they?
Liverpool Street, Moorgate.
Right,
The two ends of the... It joins those two stations, effectively, with the very long platforms. And we're working on... HS2 Old Oak Common. And have worked on we have worked on Birmingham Curzon Street and also on Euston.
Wow, okay, so real projects with a huge lifespan, I mean, in terms of real. Does that kind of weigh heavy in a sense on an architect, those projects that will...
I think Euston might weigh heavy. It's going to go on for a long time.
But I mean, in terms of the impact, projects that will outlast you as architects, be around for...
We did the master plan for Euston Station, and that was quite an eye-opener because of the scale of the project and the influence it was going to have on the area. And so we had meetings with just about everyone in the area to discuss it. So we got plenty of views back. Right. But at the end of the day, it's an opportunity to connect London or to connect the Midlands with London. And I think it's good for the country, actually.
Yeah.
I really do.
Just finally then, I'm kind of interested in, London's obviously facing a number of challenges at the moment with Brexit and with other kind of staffing issues, and in terms of, where do young architects working here, where do they live and how do they commute? Are you concerned? Are you optimistic in terms of the kind of future of the profession in London?
I'm reasonably optimistic despite all the problems, but, the one that affects the design industries, I think, is this point about, our talent pool. is relatively global, and certainly the whole of Europe. And to actually diminish that talent pool is a real problem, if that's what happens.
Yeah.
You know, one just hopes that the government could come up with a sensible sort of visa system that allows, you know, where talent and work is needed, you can actually access it. So it doesn't put people off.
And we employ, I did a little bit of research, we employ people from something like 40 different nationalities.
Wow, in the practice.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And there's been thinking about some of the international work you've been doing, I guess other practices have opened offices overseas.
We have an office in Hong Kong.
Right. What's the kind of staffing level there?
It's gone from about six. It's about six to about ten.
Right. And, okay.
But quite a lot of, I mean, it's having feet on the ground, as it were, there, which is important, and being able to respond quickly. And they can do a certain amount of design there, but we, you know, with modern IT, we can communicate very easily.
Right.
And a lot of the design can still be done centrally here.
Yeah.
You have generally about a couple of people in Australia.
Yeah.
But we don't go to conquer a place. We go for a project.
Yeah.
And obviously it's nice if we get another project alongside, but we don't necessarily expect that. We literally go to complete a project.
For a project, that's there.
And we work with local architects.
Right.
Generally.
Yeah.
And that collaborative process is, I think it's very sound, really.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both so much for your time.
Sorry about
the loud thunder and lightning and rain.
Thundering.
It seems to have cleared off. But.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Chris Wilkinson and Jim Eyre, directors at Wilkinson Eyre Architects. You can find out more about Jim and Chris at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed this programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.